If you have people who don't know the story of redemption, don't know any of those doctrines, don't know any of that content, don't know who Paul is, they don't know Job from Job, they don't know Abraham Lincoln from Abraham, who was Abram, Ur of the Chaldees, you got to contextualize.
Well, we're back on Roundtable, episode 18, discussing this topic of the church being outward-facing and outward-looking. In our last episode, our faculty spent time discussing the biblical backdrop to this very question, and they started talking about this idea of contextualization at the end, and what a great thing to explore a little bit before looking a bit more concretely at how pastors, elders, and church leaders can take concrete steps in helping churches to have this outward focus. First of all, contextualization. It's a word that we can hear a lot. It can sometimes be a buzzword, and yet it's a word that has some real value for what we're discussing and thinking about here. So joining once again around the table are Reverend Andrew Compton, Dr. J. Mark Beach, and Dr. Alan Strange.
Here's this message, and in fact, I think we can put this into an Old Testament connection just in terms of who the prophets were, right? The prophets spoke their messages into very concrete, specific periods of history, into particular eras of the kingdoms, and so their ministry was very much contextualized. Here were these grand redemptive themes that they brought to bear on such specifics as the Assyrian invasion, or allying with the Assyrians, or with the Babylonians, or what have you. And so to take this message and to very keenly aim it so that it touches down and makes sense of the specific things going on in a given church community, in a given town. So I think contextualization would be the way we have a genuinely prophetic ministry in the church.
I mean, it certainly has to do with making the gospel in no way changing the content of the message, but making the message intelligible to a given time, place, culture, setting. Something that's unintelligible can't be conveyed.
Right.
And certainly at the heart of evangelism is to convey the evangel, the gospel, to others. So the church can engage in what I prefer to call pre-evangelism work. Inviting someone to church is an evangelism.
Mm-hmm.
You're not conveying the gospel to them. You're inviting them to be in a setting where the gospel can be conveyed to them. They can hear the gospel. But if that gospel message is presented in a manner, in an idiom that they can't comprehend, it's like speaking a foreign language to them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you don't know French and the preacher speaks French, well, you're not in the right context to hear the gospel. You speak English. You need the gospel conveyed in English. Well, that's an obvious sort of example. But the church comes to the world with this great good news, this gospel message. And the church has to learn to think the world's thoughts after it so that it can convey the gospel in a way intelligible to them, redefine ideas, take what they're able to track with, and bring the good news of salvation into that to redefine old ideas and habits of heart. To me, contextualization is speaking in an idiom that the world, worldly people, and of course by world, that you can have all sorts of different contexts, a lot of different sorts of beliefs and systems of ideas. You're speaking the gospel in a manner that the Holy Spirit's pleased to effectually use to bring that gospel home. In other words, you're trying to remove obstacles. You're trying to break down barriers. In a way, contextualization is the manner in which parents speak to 5-year-olds versus 15-year-olds versus 25-year-olds. Contextualization for the church, how you would speak to a upwardly mobile Chicagoan or a Manhattanite is going to be different than Billy Bubba at the bar in Springfield, Missouri or someplace. Context is exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, preachers in our circles do contextualization. Well, my people know the confessions. They expect this. They already understand the following about doctrine and the gospel and the story of redemption. I can assume they get these points already. I don't have to spend any time talking about that. Well, you're contextualizing at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, if you have people who don't know the story of redemption, don't know any of those doctrines, don't know any of that content, don't know who Paul is, they don't know Job from Job, they don't know Abraham Lincoln from Abraham, who was Abram, Ur of the Chaldees, you got to contextualize.
And isn't it, yeah, and like you're saying, the it's unfortunate, though, that the contextualization is then being limited to that inward focus we were just talking about in our last episode. There's no assumption that anyone from the outside may be listening in. There's no sense that they may have something to learn there. We just often hear in classes at the seminary, we'll talk about the use of theological language in our preaching, you know, or the specific theological grammar or jargon, we might say. What's the value of using a word like eschatology? And that's a word that students love to debate. Some say you should never use it. It's just the grammar. And others will say, well, no, there is a place for specialized grammar. And yet we need to be thinking in those categories. What happens when somebody comes in from the outside and words like that get dropped? Is there some way that they are being invited to learn the great value of this language, or is it just being, or are we surprised that they're there and wondering why they would want to listen to any of this anyway?
Well, the desire to do this and the imperative to do this is very much the heart of the Reformation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were talking about, Mark mentioned a moment ago, the fact that it's sort of uncontroversial that we're going to have the scriptures in the receptor languages. Well, it wasn't. Rome forbade the scriptures to be translated out of the Latin, which they weren't given in originally, we hasten to add here, but to translate them out of the Latin. And so the ministry of the church was in many places in Europe where you had the late Latin that was often part of the Mass was now mutually unintelligible with what was developing in terms of Old French and Middle French as the Romance languages were developing, and you couldn't understand this at all. And so a great core of the Reformation is every people group should have the Bible in their language and preaching should be in their language.
Mm-hmm.
And this transformed the known world. I mean, Scott Hendricks of Princeton speaks about this, in fact, as the Reformation as being the re-Christianization of Europe. Europe was nominally Christianized. It was imperfectly Christianized. People didn't understand the gospel. So Geneva became a center of great sending out. Talk about sending out. Talk about the gospel being flung out. Mm-hmm. Geneva did that, and they did it with a great sensitivity to the receptor cultures into which they went. And we understand that just that word contextualization that we brought up the last time, we understand the misuse that's been made of it in this sense, which is to say, let the receptor culture determine what the truth is. Let it condition the gospel. So when we understand when you go out into all the world, we don't go out into all the world and let the people groups change the gospel message. We bring this unchanging gospel to an ever-changing world. And that's the direction of the contextualization, helping the world, which lies in darkness and needs
a savior needs to hear about Jesus who came as the light of the world. We're going out to tell the world about it. But we're not doing what, say, Islam really wants to do, which is to Arabize the world. You're not supposed to translate the Quran. You better learn your Arabic and read it in that. But the gospel goes out into
this
every
is
culture.
Dangerous, though, yeah. Because they have two Old Testament guys there who might, just might, I don't know, they can speak for themselves. They want to Hebraicize the world. But I'm glad that the Hebrew's been translated into the vernacular. It's interesting, Latin was once the vernacular.
Yeah.
And we mustn't forget that. That was once a common tongue, the tongue of the Roman world. And that the scriptures found themselves translated into Latin was a great blessing.
Mm-hmm.
Contextualization also goes, though, in finding points of contact, if we might use that phrase, between a given culture's way of thinking and a biblical way of thinking, which is means we don't capitulate to an unbiblical way of thinking, but we find ways to make contact where they can connect, and then we can redirect and help them understand why they have a touch of truth, or they're on to something, but they're not on to it, if you might say it that way. Tim Keller has done work in this area in which he has sought to bring the gospel to Manhattanites, which means you're dealing with very secular humanist sorts of persons who generally have a certain affluence, generally are going to be atheistic or disenfranchised church people, and live within a cultural context that's very hostile to the gospel. So to gain a hearing means you have to make some point of connection where you're making clear to them that the gospel addresses the world they live in and has values, has a respect for persons, a respect for justice, a respect for what is right and good and wholesome, that takes that and brings it to something even better, that redirects it to the truth, the whole truth, and the whole truth in Christ Jesus. Well, if we're not doing that, if we're just speaking to ourselves and expecting the world to overhear, I don't think we're being appropriately mindful of what the New Testament witness gives us of Paul trying to be all things to all men, so by all means he might win some.
Yeah, Tim was one of my teachers at Westminster, and I learned a great deal from him. And it just even Mark was being rather profound with that, but it's as simple, too, as you're in Manhattan and you have theater people. Well, you can make the connection that there's something going on in this play or this movie that has a redemptive element here. Well, the gospel is the real story of it. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're into music. Maybe they're into jazz, or they're part of the Philharmonic or the Metropolitan Opera. He has people from all those worlds there. And again, there's a great premium put on beauty. Well, here's the fount of it right mm-hmm. here. And so what the world wants but often denies in the gospel, this is a way of showing to them, no, really what you want, all of this love, this joy, this peace that you want finds its proper rootage and expression in the gospel. Not in an atheistic, materialistic, naturalistic mm-hmm. chance world, which doesn't really make any difference how we treat each other, whether we love each other. I mean, you want and you act and you live as if you're Christians. We're talking to people who are not Christians, mm-hmm. but you like the fruit of Christianity very much. The Mr. Rogers film, which is out, I'm going to just mention that because I've seen it with my wife. I know some others here have seen it. And Mr. Rogers is very much about being caring and loving and caring for your neighbor. Everybody wants that. The PBS audience wants that, but they don't necessarily, or they don't, want the Christianity that makes it possible, that accompanies it. And so this is what we're doing here when we talk about contextualization. It's prophetic, right? But God himself does it. I mean, think, one of the most striking instances, isn't it, in the Bible, is that remarkable situation on Simon the Tanner's roof in Acts 10, where God tells Peter, he gives him this remarkable vision, and he says, "Rise, kill, and eat." And Peter's like, "No way, I'm going to eat kosher. I've never eaten this kind of stuff." And God makes it very vivid and clear to him what he means by that. What I call clean, you don't call uncommon. And he says, a new day has arrived, where a lot of what we were talking about earlier, these separations, these barriers are down. And you better go, do you know about contextualizing? And it leads Paul to say, I become all things to all men. Now, I know that I said that once in a context, and somebody said, oh, you had to be careful about that. A lot of liberals say that. Well, I don't think we think Paul was a liberal, okay? I think we think Paul is good, and he said it. Well, what did he mean? I think he means he properly contextualizes. I think that's what Paul means.
Yeah, I mean, Keller talks about, and whether you like or dislike Keller is not what's germane here, but the basic idea, you need to commandeer in order to confront. And he talks about tactfully confronting. A writer like Brian Chappell talks about in sermon writing having a fallen condition focus. What does a given biblical text say? And what's its fallen condition focus? Well, that can be a little artificial in how you apply that. But we need to actually talk about where people are living. Some have children who are addicted to heroin or some other sort of drug. You have people in our culture who don't really get the sin guilt thing immediately, but they know a great deal about injustice. They know about economic struggle. They know about infidelity. They know about betrayal. They know about their own failures of commitment. Well, in other words, they know brokenness. They know the misery of sin if they don't quite get the guilt of it. Well, a contextualized gospel is bringing to bear the good news of salvation upon which they sort of get. And now you can give them better categories.
They know there's something wrong.
Yeah, they get what yes, they know something's wrong. So the creation itself impresses itself upon them, and they keep trying. They chase idols as answers. They keep chasing idols. Well, we confront their idols with the gospel, and we show them the true Lord, the true God, the true Savior. But if preaching is not doing that, you're not contextualizing. You're not speaking to them, their hearts, their hurts, their brokenness, their worries, their idols. You're being kind of irrelevant. You know, you're speaking in an idiom that's for somewhere else. You know, you're speaking 5-year-old speech to 25-year-olds or 25-year-old speech to a 5-year-old.
And you think of the person who wants to bring a friend to church, right? Not somebody who's saying, I've never bothered to talk about the Christian faith with my neighbor. I just want to bring him to a service and boom, have him do that. And then we'll talk in the next episode about some objections to contextualization, how sometimes that's been used in favor of like a seeker sensitivity that has gone overboard. But let's just take here this person who wants to bring a friend to church and yet says, wait a minute, my pastor doesn't say anything that will really connect with them. He doesn't define terms in any way. He doesn't speak in a way that my friend who's very immature in what they're learning can at least find some connections.
This couldn't possibly be a Reformed pastor.
Oh, we don't do anything like that. Well, but even step beyond preaching. Look, what is our bulletin? Or what are our worship services? Or what information do we give visitors when they walk in the door? We're very comfortable with the idea of a bulletin. We hand it to somebody, we know where to look. We know there's going to be some preliminaries about who has coffee duty and what people are in nursery, and we know that there's going to be a little bit of background, but you have to turn to page whatever to find the actual start of the worship service. And at the end of that will be some other kind of administrative things. But an ordinary person coming coming in may not know any of that? Can our bulletins be contextualized so that people will really find this as a tool that helps them see how this service is unfolding, how this story is being told yet again in worship that is making sense of their lives? Right, bulletins are just one example, but we can think of that.
Think of trying to enter the life of the church. You have some broken family, and we're going to try church, family.
Yeah.
We're going to get back to God, and we're going to try church.
Right, right.
Well, here's one. Let's try it.
Let's see what they do.
Well, how hard is the on-ramp into that church? I mean, all of us drive. And we know good traffic signs from poor traffic signs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all kind of Google map dependent today to find our way around. But if you can think back a little bit, when you actually looked at a road map and you, okay, I got to get off at such and such and follow. And following up what you're saying here, this business of something as simple as a bulletin.
Mm.
Something as simple as when you walk through the door, is there someone to welcome me, to point me, not merely point me, but usher me, usher me to a nursery.
Welcome
to introduce me
to
the nursery helpers for my children, to show me, to let me be as inconspicuous as I want to be, but as helpfully, ushered about and introduced as I need to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've seen a variety of churches that are very effective at that, but it doesn't seem to be on a lot of Reformed churches' radar. And if it's becoming on the radar, it's only very recent. So contextualization means a lot of things. The gospel message we speak, the church culture that's going to unfold, is it attempting to be unfolding? And as you pointed out, even our worship, our buildings and so forth,
Everything is
the on-ramp confusing or welcoming?
And it's something as basic as signs. Where's the auditorium or sanctuary? Where does that take place? Or somebody to say, we start out in here and we visit a little bit. And then we go into here, and this is where we worship. Now, some people will have that background, but not everybody will.
Well, see, right.
And let me say something that, people would differ about. But we need to know how to handle this. Let's suppose somebody comes in, it's after church, it's coffee hour, and somebody mentions a television show. Somebody mentions a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody mentions a book. Okay, so do we want to take this road? Well, I don't. We're Christian here. We don't look at such.
Oh, yeah.
We don't read such. Why don't you think about saying, oh, that's very interesting. Let's say you don't look at it. I'm not saying you got to look at it. But how about saying, oh, that's very... What do you like about that?
Yeah.
What do you like about that show? Are we going to respond in... This is a pretty simple one. I think if we refuse to do that, we're responding in fear. Not faith. Is our Christian faith so fragile that somebody saying something this contrary is going to crush it? It shouldn't be. And we should be able to say to somebody who mentions something of the world, well, what do you get out of that? Because then that puts us in the place that Mark was talking about a moment ago, to make that point of contact, perhaps, and to show them a better way, to show them, they're wanting peace, they're wanting joy, they're looking for it in idols. So it's even how to know how to engage people in their idols. If somebody just comes off the street and our response is, that's an idol, I don't have anything to do with it, they don't even know what we're talking about. What are you talking about? This is something I like. What do you mean? What's wrong with it? So why do we need to have that argument right there? Why don't we rather say, what do you get out of that? And so you're getting at the heart of what they're, why they like to look at this.
Well, find a way to disciple people. And if Jesus could spend 3 years with his own disciples thereabout, and they still were stooges in a lot of ways, and he still loved them and was patient with them, why do we think it should take 3 sermons and a little Bible study after church with the pastor for 6 weeks, and they should be fixed?
Right.
They should be fixed.
Which means they should be like us.
Like us.
Well, maybe it's going to take 10 years for someone to work through different issues and habits of heart. This is contextualization is a church being a community of broken sinners living out of the grace of God in Jesus Christ. And it's, we haven't even talked about this, but creating a body life, a fellowship of church, in which I can bring the lost neighbor, not only because the preacher gets that he needs to speak, but the people in the church aren't going to look at those people askance and talk about them but not talk to them. And when they discover that they're rough around the edges and maybe don't dress right and maybe brought a Starbucks cup to church or something, rather than rebuke them for going to Starbucks, they're going to try to learn about who they are and how they can befriend and disciple them.
Or maybe even they're transgendered or something like that.
Well, that too.
And we don't really want them there, and we do everything we can to communicate. We really don't want your kind here.
Seems like Star Wars. Your kind aren't welcome here.
Well, it's really remarkable, and as I'm thinking about what we've talked about here, boy, there's really a lot that we as pastors and as elders and deacons and other kinds of church leaders, as church members, there's a whole lot of things that we take for granted. And we really have to, I guess, surprise ourselves with how much we take for granted and how little many people will be aware of a lot of these things. And we need to be prepared to be really surprised by people's behavior or people's questions when they come in and be okay with that.
In our next episode, our faculty will take up some seeming pitfalls, thinking of ways in which contextualization seems to be leading down a dangerous path, and asking the question, is that something that means we should retrench in a safe area? Be alert next Thursday, February 13, for that episode. Until then, stay tuned in to our podcast episodes through our sermon audio page on our website at www.midamerica.edu/podcasts or via our YouTube channel, search Mid-America Reformed Seminary. I'm Jared Luchabor. Until next time.